This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Masserol. Are you ready to discover your True North Story? Guarda questo.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, as we start the podcast. Tama, why don't you fill us in on Chris and his journey a little bit?
Yeah, Christopher Kelly is an author, historian, media person.
World traveler.
And you call yourself an IBM. So tell people what that is.
IBM. I'm Italian by marriage. I'm IBM. And with a name like Kelly, I'm not very Italian, but I have been Italian for 23 years. So I have this Italian connection. I'm also a recovering television broadcaster. So I have a broadcasting background as well. But I had this love for military history, a lifelong passion for it. And I was able to scratch that itch, so to speak, after kind of getting out of the television business and after having this kind of encounter with an English historian, Stuart Laycock, who wrote a book called All the Countries We've Invaded about how Britain invaded 90% of all the countries in the world. And I wrote a review of that book. And we met in a pub in London about 5 years ago, and we became friends. And as an American, I was curious to see how American history compared with Britain's. I mean, we don't have as much history as Britain, but we certainly have been catching up in the invasion category, so to speak. And so together we wrote America Invades, and we found that America hasn't invaded 90% of the world like Britain, but we've done about 44%. We've fought in about 44% of all the countries in the world, and we wrote this book called America Invades, and we also detailed military involvement in countries too, like Portugal. We haven't invaded Portugal, but we Americans have had bases in the Azores since World War II, and they're still there to this day. So we counted that as a category of military involvement. If you add up military involvement as well as invasions, that we've been touched almost every country in the world. Only three that we've missed entirely are Andorra, Bhutan, and Liechtenstein. So that was...
Holy cow.
That was America Invades.
Wow.
Going from the revolution to the present day. But the one country we left out of America Invades was the United States itself. And we felt that we needed to come back and talk about fighting on American soil. And so this is why we did this, our sequel, America Invaded, a state-by-state guide to fighting on American soil, where we talk about fighting during the American Revolution, during the Civil War, Native American conflicts, even things like in the 21st century, terrorist attacks that have been going on in very recent history.
It's unbelievable. And I want to let our listeners know, these books are amazing. Chris has brought copies. They are gorgeous. They are absolutely gorgeous. And the material inside, photographs and maps and things, are just breathtaking, really outstanding. Nice work, Chris.
Thank you.
You've done a wonderful job.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the whole writing a book, publishing a book. For those people who say...
Let alone four.
I've always wanted to write a book about something. I've got an interest. What was that whole process like for you?
I think, you know, they say everybody has a book in them. I think that's true. And sometimes it just needs to be coaxed out. I mean, that everybody is passionate about something. And so I think it's a question of channeling and directing your focusing your passions on trying to, on the written page, on trying to come up with something of interest and that speaks truly. I mean, with history, obviously, you want something that's true. The one challenge with history is sometimes you can either be true or you can be original, but it's hard to be both. Because, like, if you say that Julius Caesar was assassinated, people say, well, that's true, but it's kind of an old story. But if I say Julius Caesar was assassinated by the CIA, you might say, that's very original, Chris, but probably not true.
Not so factual. Right.
So,
exactly.
So it's trying to combine something that's both an original slant on something that's also true, I think is the challenge to deliver interesting and entertaining history to the reader.
Probably did a lot of research.
We did, yes. Lots of research, the photography as well. We tried to, we haven't traveled everywhere we've written about, but we've traveled to a lot of places and gotten a lot of photography to try to show the readers what we're talking about as well. So we have a picture, for instance, in America Invaded in the Oregon chapter of something called the Mitchell Monument, which is near Bly, Oregon, and it's in a Weyerhaeuser forest. And this monument is where six Americans in the spring of 1945 were killed by a Japanese balloon bomb. There's one woman and five teenage kids that basically touched a balloon that they thought was, you know, a balloon, and it detonated. And today there's this monument in this Weyerhaeuser forest, and there's a picture of it in the book. And this balloon bomb campaign in the last 2 years of World War II has had very little press on it because of war censorship. Is that the government did not want people to panic about these balloons. And here we are today talking about North Korea and intercontinental weapons and all this. But there's a precedent for this. I mean, that yes, the Japanese, and it was mainly Japanese schoolgirls that were building these bombs out of paper and paste, sweet potato paste, and they were being sent into the jet stream and came thousands of miles and landed on over 15 different American states during the course of World War II, even landing in states in the Midwest, for example.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and this, I mean, it's something that is kind of an underreported story because of this censorship and when it first came out, that they didn't want people to panic.
You're learning history that not everybody is privy to, really, in your research.
Of course, when you get interviews with people who are veterans who served, which I have had the opportunity to do, and I mean, as you interview professionally,
right.
So I mean, it's like gold when you get somebody that is a source that has told you about what they saw and they did. Neither me nor my co-author are soldiers, but we have talked to a lot of soldiers and gotten their stories and tried to put those into the books as well.
You cannot compare to someone who lived it, who experienced it, and who can tell you from personal experience what that's like.
Right.
And I fear, Tam and I talk about this all the time, that especially in the media today, we see so many people reporting or running with stories that have unnamed sources or one, if they're lucky, unnamed source. When I worked at CNN, if you had to have credible name sources, minimum three, before you could even get to the editor with something that they would even look at as remotely credible. And today it's just anything goes, and it's like, well, I've got an unnamed source that said this. And so let me back up a little bit and just ask you,
sure.
You mentioned Stuart Laycock, who is the co-author with you. What was that process like for both of you to write together? Because that's always a challenge, too.
Well, Stu and I have become great friends. We're both, you know, roughly the same age. I mean, they say Stu has a lot more courage than I have. because, I mean, he was not a soldier either, but he did serve in a war zone. After he went to Cambridge, and after that, he served in Bosnia during the Yugoslavian War.
Oh, my goodness.
Doing humanitarian relief. And he lost many friends.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
And he's actually written a volume of poetry called Zone, of being in a war zone as a poet.
That was brutal too.
So, and he did that as I have nothing to do. I have no poetic gift whatsoever, or gift for fiction or any of that. But anyway, he's kind of a Renaissance guy, but he loves history. And it was his teenage son who asked him the simple question, "Dad, how many countries have we, meaning Britain, invaded?" That started this whole thing off. So it was like this: his son Freddie asking that question that triggered all of these books. Really,
that is awesome.
So you had a great collaborative effort at first together, and then did you have to find an agent? Did you have a publishing house? Did you self-publish? What was that like?
We are kind of a hybrid. We do self-publish, and mainly in the States we were self-published, but we have some traditional publishing aspects too. We wrote a book called Italy Invades. It was our second book. If you think about, okay, Britain is the empire the sun never set upon, America is the superpower, but Rome is kind of the grandfather of all empires. Mm-hmm. So that's why we turned to Italy, and also my personal connection, my IBM connection. We did Italy Invades, and that one, for instance, has just been translated into Italian this summer and has been published as with an Italian version with a traditional publisher called Polistampa out of Florence. And we also have a traditional publisher out of the UK that's published a version of America Invades as well. So we're kind of a hybrid of self-publishing and some traditional as well.
Do you think part of that too is that the publisher starts to see the value and then they're like, okay,
Sure.
We'll take the risk on Chris and Stu at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a great idea, but I'm not sure how we could sell it.
Right. Yeah. And maybe that's
but
part of it.
Here's the book you can sell.
Stu's written a number of things on his long before I met him. I mean, he's an expert on Roman Britain and has published extensively on that, too. I mean, he and I are neither of us are academic historians. We're not history professors.
Right.
But we're just
right.
guys who love history and love to share our passion for it with people. And we feel that in a sense that history is too important to be just left to the professors. I mean, that it's for every history is for everybody.
I think the most important thing, obviously, you touched on, Chris, is the passion,
mm-hmm.
because that's what comes through.
Right.
You know what I mean? And
sure.
people who also share similar passions or maybe didn't even think about the concept and then see your passion in
right.
the final product, in the book, in the narrative. And that's got to be, I'm sure, very, very pleasing for you to see other people engage and interact with your books and stories.
It's great to try to spread the word as widely as possible about, we're not trying to in any way celebrate war. I mean, war is a very wasteful thing and
right.
often tragic, but at the same time, we feel it's very important to remember what's mm-hmm. gone on in the past and the sacrifices that have been made and follies and all the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And that leads into a really interesting point. And I'm not, once again, you know, this is not a political podcast. I wonder sometimes about the history, not only of America, but of the world, that future generations are learning or are not learning in school, because we hear a lot about they're not getting an accurate amount of information related to history. I know you went out on a tour and we'll talk about that. What do you think about history? Is it not being taught as much as it used to be?
I mean, for some people, history is kind of a dry and desiccated topic, and they're, it's something that it's a word that turns people off. And we try to present history that's entertaining, that is interesting, and we try to be as objective, as non-political as possible.
Right.
I mean, Stu and I have different politics, for example.
Okay.
And so we have that forces us to kind of meet in the middle on things and not try to
compromise? Like, what actually compromise? Oh, my goodness.
It's been known to happen.
What a novel concept.
But it's, I mean, I get fed up sometimes reading other history that is obviously grinding up certain acts, a political axe that,
right.
and where I feel like, okay, if the writer has gotten carried away with wanting to grind that political axe at the expense of the truth sometimes.
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
So we try to.
So you're cognizant of that you, just the facts kind of thing.
And we want to write for everybody, no matter who you voted for. I mean, I want people to.
Another novel concept. I love this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like actually understanding your audience and putting something together that is valuable, that you're passionate about, that they
right.
can interact with
right.
in a meaningful way.
Right.
And I mean, that Tam and I, that's what we try and do with this podcast.
We live obviously in a very divisive time. No question about that. I mean,
for sure.
Divided
for sure.
politically and in lots of other ways. You can parse the population and do that, all of that. But I think at the end of the day, there's more that unites us as Americans than divides us. And I mean, even, you know, going out and doing the stories that we talked about in America Invaded, I think there's a continuity. For instance, I happen to have the opportunity to visit Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where Flight 93 went down recently, a very moving place, and a place that I think has lots of lessons to teach all Americans about what it is to be an American. Because I think about like those passengers that boarded that plane, and they came from all, I mean, there was a really diverse group. I mean, you had men and women, older, younger, a couple college kids. Some of them were not Americans. You had a Japanese national. You had a New Zealander, German citizen. And there was gay and straight. And there was, you know, I'm mm-hmm. sure every political shade and was there. But they came together. And when there are a lot of things we don't know about what happened with Flight 93.
Right.
But the three things we do know. One is that once they knew the information of what had been going on with the attacks, they voted. Two, they took action. And three, their action saved countless lives. I mean, that plane was 20 minutes away from the Capitol building when it went down on 9/11, about 10:03 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it was, you know, headed for that. And they were acting as what I would call citizen soldiers. And they were conscripted by fate, if you will.
Right.
And they had nothing in common otherwise except they were trying to fly from Newark to San Francisco that day. But they acted as citizen soldiers in much the same way that you had citizen soldiers during the American Revolution. Captain John Parker on Lexington Green, and he was reacting to the tyranny of George III. These guys were reacting to the tyranny of those people who had seized that cockpit that day.
Learn, love, listen, live. This is True North Story. the original podcast series. And now, back to the program.
What did you take away from being in Shanksville yourself?
I found it, an incredibly moving place to be. I think that battlefields can be kind of eerie places, can teach us about history. I mean, going to Gettysburg, for example, teaches us about the difficulty that America has had to have this kind of rebirth of democracy that led to extinction of slavery and all of that, and to create, to refashion our democracy. And so Gettysburg teaches us one lesson. Flight 93 teaches us other lessons, though, too, that are also tremendously important. And I mean, these battlefields are sacred spaces, mm-hmm. I guess. And I think it's important for us to visit them and to remember the lessons that they provide.
And that leads in kind of where we are in the state of America, Civil War, and with other monuments, historically speaking, and people, you know, there's a strong desire in this country to remove them. Mm-hmm. From the modern consciousness. What are your thoughts on that?
You take it like the motto. There's a motto on our coins, and it says "E pluribus unum," and we don't think about that motto very much. But it's many into one. These people on Flight 93, I think they lived "E pluribus unum" in a way that most of us, you know, never even think about or have a chance to do. But in terms of the monuments, though, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question. It's a question that, you know, divides
right.
us
know,
as opposed to unites. But I think here are the things I think. There are a couple principles. One is, I mean, I don't think that we should promote slavery. I don't think we should glorify the Confederacy. But I do think that it's very important to remember history and to remember the good, the bad, and the ugly bits of history.
For sure.
And because it's all part of our past. And also, I also think that about 850,000 people were killed in the course of the Civil War. It's the bloodiest war in our nation's history. If you're pulling down these statues with bungee cords in the dead of night, it's incredibly dangerous. I mean, do you want to have Civil War casualties in the 21st century to add to those we had before? You know,
right.
I don't think so. Ultimately, I think that you've got to have local control over this. It can't be imposed by the federal government. It's got to come from local standards, wherever they are, about whether people keep this statue in place or move it to a museum or however they deal with it.
It just gets into a real slippery slope of who's deciding what for whom.
Right.
You know?
And it's also, destroying statues is not always a virtuous thing. I mean, I talk in America Invades about, in France, there was a monument to Americans from the First World War that was erected like in the 20s. And it was a naval, you know, monument. And when Germany occupied France in 1940, they saw this monument. They didn't like it very much. They destroyed it. And so it had to be rebuilt in the 50s after World War II. So just because you're destroying a statue doesn't make you a good guy, so to speak.
We've seen that with ISIS, right?
ISIS has taken a blowtorch to history in places like Palmyra. And shocking, absolutely, you know, from a human level, from a historical level, their antipathy towards, you know, the past and is...
At running a risk of being extremely cliched, I don't mean to be, my father had his master's in history, but those who don't learn from history or don't remember history are often doomed to repeat it. I mean, I think that that's an important lesson to take away, too, is that it's a marker of, yes, some things that we have done in the past, perhaps as, you know, as a society that are less than positive, but yet it's also a sign of how far we've come forward from that, too, in an evolutionary... I'm like you, Chris. I want to be inclusive and I want to find the point of compromise and I want to be able to, Tam and I want this podcast to be unifying in our message because I just think that's important. There's so much good out there to be shared and for people to engage with and interact with that to focus on that which divides is, I don't think if there's a lot of value in that necessarily.
Well, and now I'm talking now to two people from Chicago who might be Cubs fans.
Cubs
fans certainly know that history does repeat itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And a Sox fan we could never be. So, uh-huh. You know, so you want to talk about division, you brought me right back here. I'm like, we can't stand the White Sox.
That's right.
You know, there's
a
same
north,
city,
south dividing line.
North side, south side.
Well, let's just move on a little bit here into your tour that you've been on.
You're all over, right?
All over. You've taken America Invaded. And tell us a little bit about where you've been and the experiences you've had.
Well, we have been all over. We started in Seattle, Washington in August. We went out to all the way to the East Coast. We were on board the battleship New Jersey for Labor Day. We were supposed to be headed south to Florida when Hurricane Irma had something to do. We had to cancel a bunch of things there, diverted to Tennessee and Kentucky. And so,
Your van is parked in Houston right now, which is, so you got Harvey. Good grief.
That's right. We have toured Houston, Texas as well, and seen some of the devastation there, which is very sad, and it has affected, of course, millions of people across Texas. And so, and it's interesting, you talk about unity and division and the way that Pearl Harbor obviously united America politically, maybe more than ever before or since. There was a purpose after the Pearl Harbor attack that Americans had to win the war as quickly as possible, and natural disasters also, you know, have this effect of
unifying,
the country at least, and to say like, I mean, the rain is not, it's not left or right. It's no, it's just the natural phenomenon that has to be, and we all have to deal with.
Yeah.
And it affects all of us wherever you stand.
Happened to be. Wherever you were tuning in, whether it was social media or television or picking up a paper, you were learning about these heroic things that people did for other people.
Sure. A very generous nation and giving nation. So something definitely to celebrate in difficult times.
Well, and I think that's a message that we need to remember too, that regardless of where things are, there's a lot of good that America does, and I think that can be celebrated. Are there things we need to work on? Sure.
Right. This summer, there's a really popular movie that came out, a surprise hit, Dunkirk. I don't know if you may have seen it or not.
Yeah.
But as a historian, I thought was fascinating the fact that here Americans, this is not an American story about
it's
Dunkirk,
not,
of course,
no.
at all. And it's also not a story of glory. It was really a retreat. It wasn't a victory by any means. And yet somehow this movie spoke to millions of people, not just Americans, but around the world. And I think that's kind of encouraging Dunkirk is an unusual story in that usually it's an army that's supposed to protect its people. But with Dunkirk, it was the people that came to the rescue of the army.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's sometimes a disconnect. In our country, for instance, we have a volunteer army. There's a very small percentage, maybe 1%, that is involved in the army or in defense things on a regular basis. And then 99% of us are living our lives, you know, and there's almost a disconnect between those that are in their democracy and then the very small percentage that serve. What is it that binds those together? Dunkirk was an event that bound a nation together and united Britain in a way that just, it was like their Pearl Harbor.
It's interesting because it comes full circle with Shanksville too.
Right.
Kind of.
Exactly. None of the people on Flight 93 were either serving soldiers or the police or air marshals. They were all citizens. Ordinary citizens going about their business.
Who came in to save the lives potentially of other citizens.
That's right.
You know, who might not even know that impending harm was coming their way.
And I mean, they're not militaristic. Mm-hmm. I mean, but they were all accorded a military funeral. I mean, ultimately, when they
and
rightly so.
Absolutely.
I've been on board ships of the U.S. Navy where they have Flight 93 flags. I mean, I've been on board them in Seattle, and also the intelligence community celebrates the Flight 93 citizen soldiers as well.
That's amazing. It was on 9/11. Someone was playing audio of the cockpit recordings, and it's just haunting. It's like everything is normal until it's not normal.
Right.
You know, the pilot's talking to the co-pilot, you know, air traffic control is waving them out of one sector to another, you know, and passing them off, and everything is perfect. And then all of a sudden it's not. And we know how that story ends. And it is. It's very emotional. And but it speaks to your point to the best of who we are in terms of, you know, our willingness to stand up. Tama brought it up when we were talking earlier. We all hope that we have that kind of grace under pressure if we were in that scenario.
Right.
To be able to make that kind of decision. I don't know.
It's incredible to think about what they did in such a short time. And yeah. I mean, the plane was actually flying upside down when it was pulled in. And so you imagine, how do you storm a cockpit when it's, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
The laws of physics would be
incredible.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
Back to your journey across America.
Sure.
So this is really interesting to me, because just having come to Seattle from Atlanta and, you know, grown up in Chicago, this is a big country.
Right.
And it's very different, with lots of different people and different cultures and all that. What were some of the takeaways? I know Tama touched on this, but just how many states did you cover? How long were you gone? Just kind of give the people the depth and scope of your journey.
It's about 6 weeks, about 30 states or so we've gone through or will go through. One thing that sticks out, we were in Norfolk, Virginia. Norfolk, of course, a big Navy town. We were in a restaurant and they said, oh, you've got to go to this church and go take a look. And I said, why is that? Okay, well, this church was built like in the 18th century. And it's an Episcopal church in Norfolk, Virginia. It's got a cannonball embedded in the corner of the church that was fired by the British Navy in 1776. Talk about America being invaded. That's something that I wish I'd had that picture in the book before. But I mean, that there's this cannonball sticking out of this church that they left. I mean, again, a sign of fighting. I mean, our country has been fought over in every state over the course of our history. And that fighting has shaped our country in all kinds of ways.
Did you take pictures while you were on your journey, or are there things that you documented for future use?
Yes. Yeah. I took lots of photography, took shot some videos too, which we'll eventually try and figure out what to do with. We took a GoPro video of crossing the Delaware, where George Washington did. There's a Washington's Crossing in Pennsylvania. And I took the GoPro, you know, and did a little narrative of things like that. So it was fun to do. I mean, our country has been shaped by these invasions. Like, to say something really obvious, I mean, Alaska is really different from New York. And it's obviously different geographically and climatically. But it's also different in terms of its history and the way that Alaska was invaded differently than New York was invaded. Alaska was invaded and colonized by the Russians. And you've got Russian churches in Sitka, Alaska today. And the native Alaskans, most of them are Christian, but they're neither Protestant nor Catholic. They're mostly Orthodox, which is a legacy of Russia, even though Russia left in 1867. And then on the other hand, New York was invaded by the Dutch. And they launched more of a kind of a commercial invasion. And they famously bought Manhattan Island of Manhattan.
Right.
And they also erected something. I mean, because the Dutch were themselves worried about invasions. They were worried about a British invasion from Connecticut. So they built a little something called a wall, which, you know, didn't actually protect them from, because the British did invade. But that is why we have Wall Street today.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA.
These invasions have shaped our country and formed them in ways that, you know, that might be surprising for readers.
Tell us a little bit about the bourbon journey that you went on.
Well, because we diverted away from Florida, we ended up going through Kentucky, which was a lot of fun. And bourbon, I mean, it's interesting that bourbon, of course, it's a Native American spirit. I mean, bourbon has to be made with over 50% corn, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, corn didn't exist in Europe until it was discovered by. So it's a really American, corn is a really American food or commodity. Yeah. So there's a connection between bourbon and, of course, American invasions. A surprising connection, because why is bourbon called bourbon. And it has to do partly with, think about the Manhattan. You know, have you had a Manhattan?
Of course. Yeah,
for sure.
Because okay. I like bourbon.
And of course, the Manhattan sounds like the ultimate New York power drink, right?
Right.
But of course, the backbone of the drink is Kentucky bourbon right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, but there's also a New York connection to bourbon, and that is that Johnny Burgoyne led a very famous, in 1777, gentleman Johnny Burgoyne led an invasion of British troops and Hessians in the American Revolution from Canada south into New York. They captured Fort Ticonderoga. They're trying to cut the American Revolution in two because the British already had the Isle of New York that they'd occupied. So they wanted to cut the New England off from the rest of the colonies. This invasion famously failed at the Battle of Saratoga, where Burgoyne was defeated and surrendered. And his surrender, Burgoyne's surrender, led to France entering the war, American Revolution, on the side of the American patriots. And in gratitude for that, they were starting to name parts of the frontier. And so you had towns that became called Louisville, after Louis XVI, the King of France.
France, sure.
And to honor his family, Bourbon, Kentucky became Bourbon, Kentucky because of Burgoyne's surrender and the victory at Saratoga.
How awesome is that? I remember learning about the battle at Saratoga. I remember that. That is, I love stuff like that. I really do. You know, you remind me a lot of my dad because, in a really good way, because my dad
You're
would
much
just,
younger.
Much younger, yes. Yes, she can attest to that. But his eyes would light up and he'd get so excited about imparting this information to you. Not because it made him feel better, but just because he wanted somebody else to know the details about this situation because he felt they were important. And we've lost a little bit of our passion for that, for knowing more about who we are and how we got to where we are.
Mm-hmm.
What contributed to that?
Sure.
And it's not all bad.
No. No, it's not all bad, no.
What's next on the horizon for Christopher Kelly?
Well, as Stu and I are talking about a number of different books, one possibility is Ireland Invades. I mean, most people, of course, don't think of Ireland as an imperialistic nation. it hasn't been, of course. But if you just think in terms of fighting, well, if you do Irish fight a lot? Well, they do. And they've fought for everybody.
Yes.
The Pope to the French to the U.S. Army to, you know, wherever. So computer game things that I think might be interesting for aspects of some of the books, too. So,
for sure.
I think that world history is important. So thank you, Christopher Kelly, for putting world history into a beautiful format that we can engage with and learn things about and learn how far we have come.
Great. It's my pleasure.
If people want to learn more about you or find your books or read your interesting and fun newsletters, how do they find Christopher Kelly?
I have websites, americainvades.com, americainvaded.com, italyinvades.com. All of the books are available on those sites, along with other information. And they're available also on Amazon and many bookstores as well.
Chris Great. Kelly, thank you for being with us on True North Story.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter @True North Story and tune in next time for another True North Story.